Big news! Wayfair's end of season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus, amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end of season savings, and it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffin Dafford. Thank you guys for joining me on this Friday afternoon. We are going to be talking a lot of Idaho 4 and Koberger. It's not going to be limited just to the DNA. We're also going to talk about really a lot of breaking news. In fact, my plan is to have a Idaho 4 segment every week as we approach our trial date in August. I think it's really important because there's a lot going on with these hearings. There's a lot going on with the different rulings by the judge. And there's just a lot of questions. And I think a lot of evidence that has been forgotten, a lot of details that have been forgotten. So I want to make sure that we touch on all of that. I want to, all of you guys know or may know that a wonderful supporter made these amazing cookies, Break the Case cookies. And only reason I talk about them weekly, first of all, I like that it says Break the Case. But in addition to those, she made a special cookie for all different aspects of true crime. And guess what? She made a DNA cookie. And I thought that was really appropriate for this session. So I wanted to show that. Let's first of all dig in with the Franks hearing, okay? I want to explain to everybody what a Franks hearing is. And just to give you a little bit of background, if you don't know about this case, four Idaho students, Kaylee Gonzalez, Ethan, Zana Kernodle, Ethan, and Maddie Mogan, they were all murdered in Idaho at 1122 King Road in Moscow, Idaho, specifically. And here we are almost getting ready for trial, supposedly, that is going to take place in August of 2025. These young people were murdered with a K-bar knife. They were knifed to death all within about 8 minutes in the wee hours of the morning, approximately 4 a.m. Just horrible. It was a horrible case that hit us all hard. And so that's the case we're going to be talking about today for those of you who aren't familiar with the Idaho 4 case. I want to talk about the Franks hearing. So the defense motion, the defense main offense defense attorney for Brian Koberger, who is accused of these crimes, Brian Koberger attended a doctoral program in Pullman, Washington, which is just very close by in a neighboring town just across the Idaho-Washington border. And he is who was arrested and is accused of these crimes. A Franks hearing was requested by the defense team of Brian Koberger. What is a Franks hearing? A Franks hearing is essentially a hearing where the defense says, listen, all these search warrants you obtain, they were obtained due to a lie. The specific case, and I'm going to cite it, was a 1978 Supreme Court case. And in that case, it was Franks basically alleged that, listen, there were lies, blatant lies that were written in the probable cause affidavit. And the search warrants were issued based on this probable cause. And because the probable cause was based on lies, it needs to be overturned. And you know what? A judge said that is the ruling whereby now we have Franks, it's his namesake, named after him for what occurred in that case. So I want to be very clear. You can't just have a Franks hearing and call in question the integrity of law enforcement officers based on nothing. You have to have evidence, I'm going to be very clear, that the officer lied in a written statement. Lied in a written statement. We don't have any facts in this case that indicate that. None. What the defense brought forward was they really tried to hone in on Dylan Mortensen, one of the surviving roommates, on her statements that were discussed in the probable cause affidavit. More particularly, not her statements, but what they felt was not in the probable cause affidavit that she had said to law enforcement. Remember, Dylan Mortensen was likely interviewed multiple times for hours upon hours because she was such a key witness in this case. But the judge ruled, listen, there is no direct lie. That is the litmus test for invoking a Franks hearing. You can't just have a Franks hearing unless you have evidence, again, very specifically, that a law enforcement officer actually lied on that affidavit. So Judge Hippler, who is the second judge in this case, he has said no Franks hearing because there's no evidence that any law enforcement officer knowing and intentionally lied on any affidavit involving this case. So for that reason, the Franks hearing is out, and I believe that was the correct ruling. I want to also say it's very rare for a Franks hearing to be approved. And again, because the bar isn't, was there a mistake? The bar isn't, was there something they left out? That's not the bar. The bar is an intentional lie by law enforcement, and that lie had to be really the crux of the probable cause determination. So in this case, I would argue that the crux of the law of the probable cause determination was Brian Koberger's DNA being found on the knife sheath below Maddie Mogan. That is probable cause plus of his involvement in this crime in the eyes of the judge. And the judge said that in no uncertain terms. He said something like, you know, once on Friday and twice on Sundays or something. I don't know. He made a cute little quip about no matter what, that is probable cause. No matter what else is or isn't in the affidavit, that is probable cause. Twice on Sundays, I think something like that he said. So we knew early on, if you were able to watch any of these hearings, where Judge Hippler's needle was pointing on this, because quite frankly, it wasn't a difficult decision at all that he needed to make because there was no evidence of wrongdoing or of lies or anything like that. But I think it was proper for Ann Taylor and the defense team of Brian Koberger to bring all of these motions forward. They should be doing that or they're not doing their job. I know everybody says, yes, it's throwing mud against the wall, hoping something sticks. That's what defense attorneys have to do when the facts aren't in their favor. When the facts are in your favor, it's a whole different scenario and program. But you can expect, because the facts here are so lopsided, that the defense team is going to continue to try to discredit officers, try to discredit the investigation instead of keeping a focus on the facts that exist in this case. So that is the Franks hearing. By the way, I didn't say Ethan's last name. It's Ethan Chapin. so sorry. I was thinking in my mind about Ethan Crumbly because of another school shooting that was thwarted in Houston. I had that on my brain, but I wanted to make sure I mentioned his last name as well, since I mentioned the other last names. All right. I want to go on and talk a little bit about the firing squad. This has come up again, even though it was really clear back in March of 2023 and became law in July of 2023 that Idaho said, listen, we are going to have a firing squad. And it's important to understand why this happened. This happened because they had somebody on death row, and that individual, they could not find his vein to administer the lethal injection to take his life. And this happens so often. I think a lot of people don't know this, but you don't have phlebotomists. In other words, people who are trained in administering IVs and taking blood, those individuals are trained. And that's not what you have that are administering these IVs and that are trying to find the veins. So you have a lot of problems oftentimes with these executions. And what five states have done, I believe it's Utah, Idaho, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and there's one other, I don't want to miss it. I don't know if I said Utah. There is one other state. They have said, we're going to have firing squads. Oh, Mississippi, that's the other one. We're going to have firing squads as a backup because we can't send somebody to be executed and keep having all these mishaps. The other problem was a lot of times the medication that they use to really put the person to sleep, it's definitely a manner of execution that is it does not cause pain and suffering or anything like that. They really just get put to sleep. And so they've said, we've got to have a backup, those five states. Now, Idaho, what's been in the news is Idaho is moving to make a firing squad number one and lethal injection number two. They built a $700,000+ facility so that they can use a firing squad. And again, how a firing squad works is the individuals all have weapons. They aim for the heart, but no one knows who actually shoots the individual. I also want to say that if you look up all the ways you can end somebody's life, you know, electrocution, lethal injection, firing squad, hanging, all the other forms that either are used or have been used in our country's history, the firing squad is by far the most reliable. In other words, they shoot and the person dies. So that is a big point that people have considered for why the firing squad should be used. I have to tell you, it passed the House, but still has to go before the Senate and in Idaho before it becomes law. Now, this has been very important to, as an example, Kaylee Katsoffis's father and family. They want to see a firing squad. And I think even though the person is blindfolded, there is some sense that sort of being there, knowing guns are pointed at you, you know, I think that there is some feeling that there would be some suffering, at least mentally, that the person would do prior to being put to death. And, you know, a lot of loved ones who have lost a loved one, especially in this horrible, heinous way, I mean, I understand why they would want to see this put forth. And I know, you know, Mr. Katsoffis has pushed, pushed this legislation. I think it'll be passed. It's waiting before the Senate right now. And so that's where we're at. That's what's going on with the firing squad. The point is that if Brian Koberger is convicted. He's innocent right now in a court of law. If he's convicted, he could face a firing squad if that's approved by the Senate. And I think, you know, that's very interesting. But it would be way down the road. I mean, there's 11 individuals that are on death row in Idaho right now. It always takes a very long time to actually, I mean, sometimes decades before the person actually is executed. So something to keep in mind. This isn't something that's just going to have happen right away. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about trash polls. And the reason is again, the defense is trying to get a lot of evidence thrown out. In fact, they've motioned for the most important piece of evidence to be thrown out, which was the DNA that was obtained through genetic genealogy that linked Brian Koberger to this crime. They failed all motions by the defense to suppress information, or I'm sorry, evidence in this case, have been denied. So just so you all know, as of now, the motions submitted have been denied. And of course, the most important motion had to do with the DNA. So when it comes to the DNA, I want to talk a little bit about how the evidence was first gleaned to link Brian Koberger, and that was done through a trash poll. And Ann Taylor has vehemently said, you know, there was no search warrant to get his DNA from the trash. Well, I could tell you there is mounds of evidence, or I'm sorry, mounds of cases that support that trash polls are obtaining by law enforcement abandoned property. And so therefore, because you abandon it, you throw it in a trash dumpster, you throw it on a street, you abandon it as trash and discarded, you no longer have any right to privacy for that item. So that is, like I said, mounds of support at the Supreme Court level, at every level, to do a trash pull. So in law enforcement, it's one of our main tools. I'm trying to think if there was any case, very few cases that I didn't do trash pulls. I love trash pulls, even in white collar cases. You can learn so much by bills, handwritten items, who, you know, their telephone ledgers, things that they say to one another, obviously DNA. I mean, this is how, again, they caught Lisk, the Long Island serial killer, otherwise known as the Gilgo killer, Rex Heuermann. He discarded some pizza and they were able to get his DNA and match it. This is a form that's used. So Ann Taylor saying this is my point. Ann Taylor is literally throwing snowballs up against the wall, and that's why nothing is going to stick, because she's going against precedent and law that isn't going to change. And but she's got to throw something up against the wall, so that's what she's throwing. So again, she really didn't have a chance for these motions to prevail. They didn't prevail. But I wanted to talk a little bit about trash pulls. And since she brought that up in the hearings and in the paperwork. All right. Let's see. I want to talk a little bit about, because this came forward too, talking about the arrest of Brian Koberger. And I've been asked this question so many times, both within social media and mainstream media. But it's been a long time. Essentially, law enforcement is required to do knock and announce, and you're not allowed to do a warrant for an arrest pre 6 a.m. It's basically 6 to 6 is your time frame to serve a warrant normally. Now, in this case, we know Brian Koberger was served a warrant well into the wee hours of the night, around 1, as I recall, well before the 6 a.m. cutoff. And we also know that this is what I call a pretty much a dynamic entry. Okay, so we have two as a tactical former SWAT team member for 15 years. There's different kinds of entries we do. And sometimes we do basically dynamic, meaning, you know, FBI, FBI, we're here to, FBI, FBI, open the door. And then we rake and break windows. We call it rake and break. And we utilize breaching tools to open the door. Why? Why do we do that? Because surprise is an important element to safely executing a warrant against criminals who you believe to be highly, highly dangerous. So in this case, law enforcement believed and still believes that Brian Koberger killed the four Idaho students. And he did it with a K-bar knife in a totally brutal and horrible, violent manner. They also knew that Brian Koberger had a Glock. Okay? They knew he was in the house of his parents, and there were multiple concerns. One, if they knocked and announced and just sat there outside and didn't breach and didn't go in forcefully, Brian Koberger could take his family, his mother and father, and use them as hostages potentially. Brian Koberger could take his life potentially. Brian Koberger could have a standoff and put the lives of law enforcement now at peril. You know, sticking a Glock out the window and shooting at the people on the perimeter. Somebody coming, trying to come in. So it was very important that they announced and went in quickly. And to be clear, this just doesn't happen. You have to get approvals at the highest level of the FBI. So again, the SRT team went in. In this case, it was a local team supported by the FBI team. And as I recall, I need to look back at that, but I believe it was the state team that went in first, that they were the initial on point. As I recall, it was SRT. And they have to get their approvals all the way up through their command. More importantly, you have to go to your U.S. attorney or state prosecutor in this case, and it has to go to a judge to get the arrest warrant and to ask. You write it in and you specifically say it's going to be at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. It's going to be before the normal hour of 6 a.m. And you have to explain to the prosecution staff first and then to the judge why. And you're literally in chambers with the judge in case he has any questions. Special Agent Coffendaffer, why do we really need this? And in the cases where I've done that, they ask just that. Even though it's written, they want to hear it from you. They want to hear why this is less dangerous, why this is better for all involved. So I just wanted to touch on that because I think there's a lot of miscommunication about why they committed why they arrested Brian Koberger in this manner. And I know it's been brought up in recent court documents. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Okay, a couple other things. And I want to make sure I say her name right. I think it is Bicca Barlow. Bicca Barlow has been appointed as a pro hoc vice attorney. She's from California. I want to show you a picture of her. And she has been appointed as a, here we go. Hopefully you can see that. I've got a lot of glare on my windows. I have a lot of windows here. She is going to serve as counsel another counsel during the trial for Brian Koberger. Yes, it's going to cost a ton of money. But one of the other attorneys that initially had that role is now been demoted sort of to a counseling position for whatever reason, you know. But the reason she is important, and I wanted to bring her up. Well, first of all, I think it's important to know that there is another counsel on this case. Her background is DNA. She is a DNA expert, it would seem. I mean, her resume is so impressive. I posted it on Twitter if you want to take a look. Very impressive. She is very well educated regarding DNA. And I think that they've brought her on. In fact, I believe very strongly they've brought her on because it's going to be important for somebody that really understands DNA to be able to cross-examine the experts in this case. You don't want your average Joe cross-examining these experts that are going to be up there because you want somebody that really knows what they're talking about. So I consider it a very smart move. I'm unsure as to why their other DNA attorney that they've had from the beginning of this case, why he all of a sudden wasn't good enough, but maybe he had other commitments. Maybe he's not able to serve in that role as strongly as they wanted, or maybe she knows more. Ms. Barlow knows more, and Ann Taylor's more impressed with her. I don't know, but that is a big change that's happened. Okay, really quickly, before I get to the meat and potatoes, we're going to get into the DNA issues. I want to say I was so proud when I was contacted by Aura. And Aura is a company that specifically helps you maintain issues concerning identity theft. You don't want your identity stolen. You want it protected. There's tens of thousands of individuals that have their IDs stolen, their identification, I should say, stolen every year. And Aura keeps that from happening. They have 24/7 service. They monitor transactions with your credit. So if anything looks out of order, they notify you. They have all sorts of protections in terms of scam calling that they can put on your devices to keep you safe. They have VPN safe browsing tools that you can use. So I just want to say, and it'll be linked in this, but if you are looking for something like that, please just use the QR code and my name that you're going to see below, and you get 2 weeks free. If you like it, great. If you don't, get rid of it. But at least you gave it a try, and you protected yourself for those 2 weeks. I believe in it and glad to support it. All right, moving on. I want to talk about the blood on the banister and the blood on the glove. Okay, let's start with the glove. I'm going to show you a picture of the glove that is in question. This glove, I believe, was the glove that was found by a YouTube former detective in California. And he found it, and this is critical, 11 days after, on Thanksgiving, 11 days after the crime was committed against the Idaho Four, and they were murdered. Where the glove was found, I want to show you just a couple of pictures of the glove here. You'll see it's very hard to see, actually. Can you see it there? It's hidden below these leaves right here and kind of buried in the snow. A little bit better picture of it is right here, I think. You see that right there? So that's the glove. Again, it's kind of like this. Okay. And where it was found specifically was right by the garbage cans on the curtilage of 1122 King Road, just barely inside the evidence tape, kind of below leaves and snow, and again, was found right by the trash cans. I've always maintained that that glove was either left by a, you know, someone who did the garbage or somebody who was passing by. There could be a multitude of reasons. Did law enforcement miss that glove? We have absolutely no evidence that they missed that glove. I think it could be much more possible that somebody that's a passerby, obviously there were dozens and dozens and dozens of people that were gawking at the house at 1122 King Road after these horrible murders happened. And like I said, it was right on the curtilage of where that crime scene tape was and the trash cans were. The trash cans are here, crime scene tape is here, and the glove is here right below the trash can. On that glove, we now know, we've known that male DNA was on that, but we didn't know what kind of DNA. We now know that the DNA source was blood, right? I've said this over and over again. You can have blood and or semen or saliva or tears, sweat, skin cells, all of that are sources of DNA. And one source isn't worse than the other source. If they have identified, if they have enough skin cells or enough saliva to make a full DNA profile, that's what it is. In this case, they have not identified the male. And what this means is that they haven't done a comparison with somebody that it's matched with. So it didn't match with Brian Koberger, didn't match with Ethan, it didn't match with the other party goers, whoever else they matched it against. There's no match. It's unknown. Now, the interesting piece was CODIS, which is where it's the database of DNA, if you will. It's like APHIS is for fingerprints. In other words, that's where you send something to get a match. And in this case, I read in the recent court documents that the FBI did not send that through CODIS. Why? There are certain parameters that you have to have, apparently, to be able to send it through CODIS. So the last reading I have is that it was not sent through CODIS. I'm going to do more exploration on this topic because that doesn't really jive with anything I've ever known as an agent. When you have an example of something that's in an ongoing criminal investigation involving four homicides, I'm not sure I understand that assertion. So I need to look further into that. But I want to understand that no matter what, though, the point is it's unknown. It hasn't been able to be matched to anybody with a match. The other blood that was found with DNA was on the banister at 1122 King Road. Now, I want everybody to think about this, like in the house that you live in. And if you were ever in college and lived in a dorm, lived in a party house, lived in a house with numerous roommates where there was numerous traffic going through, even your personal house right now, I can tell you if people came into my residence, there is so much DNA all over the place, not only of my direct family members, but of all the friends, all the family, all the friends of my children, everybody who has been in this house, there is the possibility of DNA. And at least in my house, there are areas and surfaces where blood could easily be. Why? Well, take an example. I have a hangnail right now, and there's a little blood at the edge. a person could have a hangnail, a person could have, otherwise marked or nicked their finger and touched something in my home, a chair, picked up a chair, sat down, had their fingers on the countertop. Obviously a banister railing that you hold to go up. If anyone had a nick or a cut or anything like that, it would make sense that you could leave a little bit of blood behind with DNA. And who in the world are you going to match that to at 1122 King Road when that was party central? Remember all the footage we posted where the police would go? One time, at least one time, they went and none of the roommates were there. None of them. They were all out and about at other parties and things. That was a party house. There were people going in and out of there that none of the occupants knew, that no one, it was a party house. That's where people went. And so to say that blood, now it'd be a whole different thing if that blood was found on any of the deceased victims, below the deceased victims, on their clothing, in and around where they were laying, on their pillow, on their bed, on a knife sheath. That's a different question. But this is a banister and this is a glove found below a trash can on the curtilage of the property 11 days later. So this is a point that the jury is going to have to consider. And the jury is going to have to consider, is this relevant? Could this be another subject's? They're going to have to consider it, but it's for a matter for the jury to decide. And it's going to be decided. And you can guarantee that a lot of that is likely coming in and it should come in. But the fact that those items weren't mentioned in a probable cause affidavit does not beget a Franks hearing. Because for the reasons I just named, the other thing is a probable cause affidavit, most of the ones I've written and most of the ones I've read are a page long on the outside, 2 pages long. I mean, the outside of usualness. Probable cause is the second lowest of standard in law. Reasonable suspicion is first. Probable cause is above that. Now, don't get me wrong. These prosecutors, when they read these affidavits, they are looking for beyond a reasonable doubt. Make no mistake. They do not want to sign off on anything that doesn't tip the scale toward reasonable doubt, meaning that it's pretty much beyond reasonable doubt. That's what they like to see. And I call them whale in a bucket. That's what they want to see, a whale in a bucket. So in this particular case, the fact that everything they had done on that investigation for 5 weeks isn't in there. It couldn't be in there as it was. It was, 20 pages long. It was a long probable cause affidavit. I had never seen anything like that. I mean, anybody and everybody I spoke to about that in law enforcement and attorneys, it was impressive that they put all that information in there. And I think they did because they well knew the importance of this case, and they well knew the importance of giving the magistrate judge that was going to look at that plenty of information to support the search warrants they asked for and the arrest warrant they asked for. So they made it what I call a probable cause plus affidavit. All right. Let me see if there's anything else. Something else came forward, and I can't wait. I really hope you guys comment on this. Something really came forward that was interesting about Murphy. Murphy was Kaylee's dog with Jack. They both had a dog together. And wasn't it interesting that Murphy was found on a bed, a door was open, and Maddie Mogan's room was open where Kaylee and Maddie were, and the dog apparently had no blood on his paws, hadn't tracked blood, essentially maybe had not gone to see Kaylee. So that's an interesting point, I think. I think what's an interesting point to me as a dog owner who absolutely loves my dog that I sort of co-share with my son. It's really his dog, but he lets me have it all the time because he's in flight school. You know, I found it interesting that Kaylee and Maddie were sleeping in one room and Murphy was in another room. I just found that very interesting. I can't imagine a scenario where I was in the same house with my dog and the dog has a dog bed and it sleeps in the dog bed in whatever room, you know, I'm in, like right now, sleeping right here with me in his dog bed. Or when I go to bed at night, I move the dog bed in, he sleeps in the dog bed. So I found that very interesting just in the first situation that he was not in the room, that he was in a different room, and that he was apparently up on the bed. And of course, this was hours after the murders. You know, why didn't he go toward Kaylee or anybody else, really? We don't know the answer to that question. You remember, he was a young dog. He was more of a pup. I'm not sure of his exact age. I tried to find it. I don't know. I need to probably reach out and ask out of curiosity, because I don't know if you, and maybe we have a dog expert in here, if somebody with that it's a younger dog, maybe they are not necessarily going to check out the bloody situation that dog would have been able to smell and be around. You know, I don't know the answers to any of those questions. I just thought it was interesting about Kaylee's dog. Let me see. I want to make sure I didn't miss anything else. Oh, this came out years ago when Brian Koberger was arrested, but it's rearing its head again, as everything sort of is. Brian Koberger made a statement when he was arrested. I'm going to say it's in quotes, "Who else did you arrest?" And we brought that up many, many times over these past years now. And why is this interesting? Well, of course, it begs the question, which the defense is trying to put forth, that there's a co-conspirator that's out there that's not arrested. And certainly, I think at the time it happened, I think many wondered, is there a co-conspirator out there? But I would give this explanation. He was in the house of his parents. Was he wondering if he was going to be considered and drove back with his father, that his father had harbored him or aided and abetted him in some way to get away from Idaho, from Pullman, from everything that had happened? And could his father had been arrested, or his mom or both, have been arrested for harboring him, if you will? Could his mind, remember, he's a criminal justice PhD, could his mind have gone there? I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that he would be wondering that. Was anyone else arrested as a spontaneous utterance, considering the situation? You know, law enforcement crashing and banging and dynamically entering. Was anybody else arrested? I think he was talking about there at his house, referring to his parents. That's what I think. I want to get to your questions and thoughts. And yes, my glasses are still broken. I haven't had a chance to get them fixed. Let's see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Bringing up Buddy, the other dog that was found, that I did a lot of research on. That dog, that was an unrelated incident. It really had to do with two neighbors and issues between them, I believe, and that other neighbor harming, well, not only harming, I mean, that dog was brutally murdered and mistreated after his murder. and left at the owner's curtilage, as I recall. Unrelated from, I believe, from these murders and Brian Koberger. Okay, let's see. Let me see if there's anything else here. Yes, Murphy is alive and with Jack. Let me see. Let's see. Did they kill the rabbit too? I don't know about the rabbit. Well, anyway, I hope I cleared up some questions about what's been going on. I think it's really important. This was a big week. And it was a big week because of all these motions that were answered by the judge, quite frankly, that were denied by the judge. And I think most of us expected them to be denied based on the arguments that were presented by the defense. And I love that this judge is starting to unseal different motions and unseal different warrants and things. I think it's really important. When I say warrants, not what was found, but certain items, he's saying, no, we're going to unseal it. He unsealed the transcript, you know, so we could see the transcript. And this way it's transparent. He can easily show what their arguments were, what the prosecution's arguments were, and how he derived his conclusions of denying the motions to suppress and you know, why he issued his denials. So I'm so glad he's being transparent. I think that that's a good sign that we're going to be able to see this trial live, and we're going to see more released. I was very pleased to see that he, even though I was completely misunderstood, that he released and opened up that there are medical records of Brian Koberger that are in the record and Brian Koberger's family that are in the record that we could see during trial or during sentencing. Now we know they exist. Before, that was hidden, and now we know they exist. And I think that that could be very important when it comes to motive. That might be a reason why, when I say we see them, that we hear about them, that we know about them. Or if he is convicted, I think we could see them at sentencing as mitigating on behalf of the defense. So as things continue to be released and we find out new information, I will definitely weekly, likely, or at least every other week, come forward. I want to make sure there's no other questions. Let's see. Yes, the whole rabbit thing and buddy thing is really, you know, it is terrible, but it was, I believe, did a lot of research back then about that. I tweeted all about it. I'd have to look back to get all those details, but I believe it was a neighbor situation that resulted in those animal cruelty situations. I really appreciate each of you for coming in and joining. And at 4 o'clock, I'm going to be back with the Greenbergs, the parents of Ellen Greenberg, to see where that case is going from here. So I can't wait to hear from them. Until next time, may justice be served.